Hey, feeling unsure about your finances these days? You're not alone. That's why Noble Gold Investments is here to help. Just hear it straight from the people who they've helped. The Noble crew walked me through everything with no stress. With their help, I could finally sleep easy at night. And now this month, Noble Gold Investments is handing out a free 5-ounce silver America the Beautiful coin if you qualify for an IRA. Invest in gold and silver with Noble Gold Investments. Go to NobleGoldInvestments.com right now. That is NobleGoldInvestments.com right now. Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, my speech at University of Central Florida, where I take questions from the other side. It's really fun. We talk about Israel. We talk about socialism. We talk about all sorts of stuff live from the University of Central Florida. I think you'll really enjoy it. Email us, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. That is freedom@charliekirk.com. Open up your podcast application and type in Charlie Kirk Show. That's Charlie Kirk Show. I love hearing from you, so email me freedom@charliekirk.com and get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com. That is tpusa.com. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by the loan experts I trust, Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage at andrewandtodd.com.
Thank you, everybody. Sorry I'm late. As they say, complicated business. So honored to be with you guys. I want to first give it up for our police officers. They're doing such a great job, and they don't get enough respect. They do wonderful. This is my my second visit to UCF. I think I visited 5 years ago. I don't know if anyone was there. It was a much smaller room at the time. Great to be with you. I had all these, you know, I try to plan out some idea of what we're going to talk about a couple days ago. But honestly, you know, given recent events, I kind of want to address that, and then we can do some question and answer, which is the most fun. If you disagree, you get priority, so we can talk from there. So over the weekend, I turn off my phone, turn off my devices from Friday night to Sunday morning, and I allow myself to just watch college football. That's kind of like my only thing that I watch. And by the way, what is this whole thing that you guys like won the national title? Like, that's the weirdest thing, by the way. Okay. You guys, I mean, like, okay, you beat Auburn. Congratulations, right? And it was Fiesta Bowl, right? Okay, 16-0. It's, I guess it's interesting. It's, I got a whole take on that. Okay. But didn't you guys have like a parade or something? And like, you put the whole thing up. You kind of own it. This is like, it's not true, but, it's great, you know? Sure. National champions. Great. What year was that again? What year was that? Was it 17? Who won? Did Alabama win in 17? Is that right? You really think that UCF would have given the Tide in 17 a run for their money? Yeah, that's you guys are really loyal. So, yeah, that was when Tua, I think, threw the game-winning pass in the national title game in 18 when Jake Fromm was a freshman at University of Georgia. I think that's, yeah, that, anyway. Didn't plan to talk about that. Anyway, I watch college football. I love it. It's my one indulgence, despite the fact that I'm not exactly a fan of most colleges. And so I'm flipping through the channels. I love watching the Red River rivalry game. And all of a sudden, you know, I see the news reports, you know, something happens in Israel. And I, like many of you, have grown accustomed to kind of seeing that news report. You kind of say, okay, you know, Hamas, they fire rockets, or Hezbollah fires rockets, and you just kind of, you know, okay, I hope not too many people died, right? So then I kind of turn the channel, and then all of a sudden, you know, I keep going back and forth between, and they're like, oh, the death toll's at 100. I'm like, that's unusual, right? Like, death toll's at 200. I'm like, okay, but something's very off here, right? This is not exactly what we have grown accustomed to, where, you know, rockets and, you know, then there's like a 5 or 6 day, you know, conflict, and then they come to some sort of a ceasefire. And then all of a sudden, it's like 500 people. I was like, what on earth is going on here? 700 people. And now the number is 900, 950 people. And, you know, I was just kind of shocked, and to be perfectly honest. I've been to Israel a couple times. If you haven't been, highly recommend it. It will change your life. It's a really amazing, great country. in a lot of different ways. I mean, I don't agree with everything they do politically, but as a Christian, being able to actually go where Christ resurrected, where Christ walked on the water, to go prove that the Bible is true, changed my life, right? The Bible went from something that was, you know, obviously I believed in, to something like, oh, wow, that is exactly where Abraham bought the, you know, the Hall of the Patriarchs in Hebron, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah. It made me a much stronger and more serious believing Christian. And for that alone, I was just infinitely blessed that I was able to go to Capernaum and go to the Mount of the Beatitudes and go to the Mount of the Olives and go to the Garden Tomb and go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And it blew my mind. I went there a couple times. And so I see Israel completely under attack. And I assumed that it was a typical military type attack, right? So, you know, bad guys go and kill militants. But I said, something's not right here. 900 people? Like the IDF, they're like the best fighting force in the world. And I still think there's something missing to the story, to be perfectly honest. Something doesn't make sense. And I think we're going to find out that the Israeli government was double-crossed by somebody within, because there's no way that 6 hours it takes to respond for this. But this was not a typical military-type installation, operation. This was a massacre. This was the closest thing that any of you have lived through to the Holocaust in your lifetime. The Hamas militants that do this in the name of Islam, yelling Allah Akbar, go and did not seek out militants, but seek out women and children actively. Go to a concert and kill 250 people completely and totally indiscriminately. And as the reports come in, and there's some debates, you know, debates about what the, there's some reports, did they actually, you know, cut the heads off of babies or not? It could be war propaganda, but it's savagery, right? It's 900 people that we know that have been intentionally murdered. And almost like clockwork, the next day in New York City, you have thousands of people in the streets cheering this on and celebrating this. Like this is the greatest thing ever. And organized by the Democrat Socialists of America. I'll get to that in a second. And then you have members of Congress like saying, well, this is what happens when, you know, you push a group too far. Like, what would you expect? And one of the things I want to kind of paint for you tonight is the very same narratives that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are using is the same stuff that we hear in our own politics all the time. We hear it in the trans debate. We hear it in the BLM debate. And I'm going to kind of connect all of it, which is that we need to justify illegal, immoral activity by a group because the white man or Western civilization or America pushed them to a boiling point. And I'll prove it to you. After the death of George Floyd, all of a sudden there was all this looting and burning of buildings. They said, well, this is what happens when, you know, you don't treat a group correctly. No, there's never an excuse to loot and to murder and to kill and to go after police officers. That's never the right excuse. And this goes to a broader project that they're going, which is towards decolonization. And so, anyway, we kind of go into these last couple of days, and I mean, you guys have ever seen, the men will know exactly what I mean. Those are internet culture, the FAFO chart, right? Hamas is about to find out in a very serious way. I just hope, you know, not too many civilians get killed in the way. I mean that. But it was complete and total indiscriminate savagery. If you don't know what I was just talking about, Google it, I guess is the best way I could say that. So how should we think of Americans like this, about this? So first and foremost, I mean, I have a heart for Israel, so I'm kind of biased in this. I do think we should put our country first. I don't think we should put troops on the ground, nor do I think we need to, honestly. Let Israel be Israel and let them take this into their own hands, and they will. But the UN is coming out and they say, well, you know, we want a peace fire. Yeah, it's easy for you to say when 900 of your own people weren't just slaughtered in the streets. And this goes to a deeper question, which is what was on display very clearly was Barbary versus civilization. And in no context can you possibly justify, you know, as a military operation going in and just targeting the women and the children and saying, this is who I want to try to kill. And then they celebrate it, they come back to Gaza, and they get celebrated as heroes. And then on top of it, Black Lives Matter Global Network today posts on social media saying that we stand with Palestine with a picture of one of the gliders coming in. So you might say, what on earth does a Black Lives Matter activist in Chicago have to do with, you know, a Hamas militant in the Middle East? And that is intersectionality. And intersectionality is exactly why you will see on college campuses people that otherwise would completely not agree on anything come together to fight conservatives, fight America. This is why you'll see, you know, for example, you'll see like the pro-Palestine groups and like the LGBT groups. You're like, yeah, I don't think you guys really know much about each other, like at all. Like, have you ever talked? I mean, try visiting Gaza as like an openly gay person. Like, they'll give you a flying lesson off the top of a building. Like, not exactly. It's not a joke, by the way. It's like, you know, you think that America's homophobic. Yeah, go take a waltz in like a random Muslim Arab country with your gay pride flag. Won't work very well for you at all. Yet they find themselves as happy partners. And Kimberly Crenshaw, who's an academic 30 years ago, came up with this idea of intersectionality, which is that we must identify the great Satan, identify the big enemy, and bring together all of these mobilized parts. And so this is a generalization. But in America, you're usually a conservative if you produce more than you complain. You're usually a left winger if you complain more than you produce. That's the best way I can explain the right and the left, okay? Now, there's some nuance to that. You know, if you produce kids, if you produce a healthy marriage, if you have a good church, if you produce a business, if you produce for your family, you're more likely to be a conservative. If you complain more than you produce, aka liberals, all they do is complain all day long. Their entire political project, the American left, is how can I get up in life to not work and to complain? It's simplification, but it's 100% true. Take to the streets because of transphobia. You're like, why don't you get a job? Like, you go become super rich. No, because it's really a terrible country. You're just lazy. Like, honestly, like, you just don't want to work. You just don't want to work. And you want somebody else to go pay for your deranged, lunatic, delusional ideas. And you don't actually want to go wake up early and to take responsibility for your own life. And so that's the best way. Again, it's not everyone on the right can be, you know, programmed into that. But in life, if you produce, you then want to conserve. In life, if you complain, you want to tear down. Easy way to think about it, right? Again, there's some nuance to that, but that's a pretty simple way when you look at the American political project. Intersectionality is built on we are going to elevate all sorts of different groups that complain. So that's why you have the race arsonists from BLM that combine with the Palestinian groups, that combine with the LGBT groups, and they say, we are all in this together. And the group that organized that despicable rally in New York City, where they're literally saying, kill the Jews, you know, kill the Jews, unbelievable videos, right, here in America, which begs the question of immigration, which I'll get to in a second, why these people were ever let into America in the first place is, you know, a failure of our own political system. We shouldn't import people that hate the country, just pretty simple truth. But the Democrat Socialists of America were the ones that organized this. I mean, usually socialists are really worried about like going after the bourgeoisie and protecting the proletariat and the middle class. I mean, like, where in Karl Marx's manifesto does it talk about Hamas? Not there, right? In Das Kapital. But instead, Marxism has been broadened by Gramsci and Marcuse and Foucault to say anybody in power we must take out. And they identify the power structure in America as white Christian men who are in charge of Western society, and anything they support, we must oppose, and we must mobilize every group together to try to deconstruct them. Again, these people complain for a living. They're good for nothing, who do not produce anything, so they have to try to tear down what others have created. They want to tear down your family. They want to tear down your business. They want to tear down your faith. Guess what? It takes zero skill to complain. It's hard to produce. It's hard to do good things. I have no respect for somebody that says, you know, the world is just so systemically unjust and I'm going to become an activist or just kind of meander from life. It's a lie. America's broken in a lot of different ways, but if you still apply yourself, you can make something of yourself, period. There's a lot that we should do differently from a political standpoint, a lot we should do differently from a policy standpoint, but I'm not going to come up here and just say, you know what, it's completely rigged against you. What's the point? That if you want that, show up at a, you know, any one of your probably political science classes here. I don't know how bad it is here, but you could tell me. I mean, but that's basically all of the garbage that you could be fed in those classes can be summarized into that. But you would think, why would the Democrat Socialists of America be focused on that? It's because they're constantly looking at any attack vector to destabilize Western civilization. You are living in what they think is the problem. You're living in what I believe is the blessing. That is the difference. I believe you're living in an act of blessing. They believe you're living in an act of problem. People say where we can have, you know, common ground. I don't know how you find common ground. If I think we're living in one the greatest experiment in self-government in human history, and they think we're living in the most oppressed, cult, you know, awful place, where's the common ground exactly? We're not even talking about policy. The approach itself is wrong. And so this can boil down to with intersectionality is that they never want to try to improve the conditions of the groups that they allegedly represent. They would rather stay more powerful to try to call the other side fascist or enemies of democracy while never actually saying to the group of people, we're going to materially make your life better. As soon as the American left basically took over political control of the black community got poorer. It's been an awful deal for the black community. And yet they keep on electing, you know, left-wingers and people that are Marxist, basically, because, ooh, we have to be afraid of the evil right-wing conservative. Same thing could be said with Hamas and with these Arab countries. Instead of saying, wait, hold on a second. Like, okay, you guys are the Palestinian Authority. Like, why is it that Israel is able to make a desert bloom and make an unbelievable miracle in the Middle East, and like every other country that surrounds Israel is basically, outside of oil, a third world hellhole? Why is that exactly? And they don't want you to ask that question. Because they'll say, oh, Israel blockades us. No, Israel is blockaded. So don't give me that crap. Israel is the most hated country in the entire region. Every single, and they're finally making some progress, you know, peace deal with Egypt and all this. And thanks to President Trump, you know, we finally saw some things going in the right direction. But no, these Arab countries and these Muslim countries have everything at their tool and their ability to actually improve the condition of their countries, but they don't. First, they're captured by a religious ideology that prevents them from doing certain things. But secondly, some of these dictators stay in power because if actually people started to develop themselves into a middle class, maybe they would ask the question, why do we have a dictator? Like, why do we have Assad? Why do we have it? That if they actually liberalize some of these countries, and again, I'm not a neoliberal, but basically if you can own stuff and trade, your life generally is going to get better. No, but instead, they would rather stay permanently in power, and Israel for them is a license for them to stay in political power. Because they can say, look at the Jews, look at Israel. They're the great enemy. And honestly, you know, someone who's living in absolute poverty in Yemen needs to be like, we don't even border Israel. Like why don't our leaders feed us? They don't want them asking that question. And that's exactly the same reason why the people in charge of BLM in this country don't want the black community to say, wait a second, you guys have been in charge of the black community for 50 years. It's more murderous, poorer. Our quality of life has decreased substantially. We have more single mothers than ever before. How is that the white man's fault exactly? Shut up. Keep electing, you know, the black left winger because, you know, the evil fascist might come and hunt you down. They never actually care about delivering results for the communities that they represent. And it's a tragedy. Honestly, it's a tragedy. So if the Palestinians focused on prosperity instead of killing, they could live the same way. Here's a fact for you. 8% of the Palestinian Authority's budget, 8% is for a program called Pay for Slay, which means that if you are a militant and you kill a Jew, your family gets money for the rest of their life. You guys don't know this? Pay for Slay, 8% of the entire budget. So basically all of these militants that killed Jews, and they're going to be killed by the IDF, their family is going to get money. So they're subsidizing the killing of Jews. Like, how about use that 8%, I don't know, to build a school or to help people's lives? No, because they prioritize the conflict. And by the way, it's $300 million a year, just so we're clear. So they always complain, we're blockaded. We have no, wait, hold on a second. Your leaders are thugs, Mahmoud Abbas, who doesn't even want to do an election. Why don't you have that $300 million and actually spend it on the livelihood of their people? They don't want to do that. And so the other part I want to talk about is immigration, then we'll do some questions, which is, you know, I watch these rallies in New York City, and here's just a truism for life. What you allow into your country will soon become. Okay? That's not controversial. And so we don't have a southern border. I'm not here to scare you. I don't do the hysteria stuff. It's a fact that there are sleeper cells in this country. We have allowed hundreds of people on the terror watch list to come in without any sort of screening. We do not have a border, right? 8 million people have come in. We don't know who they are. They could be murderers. They could be rapists. They could be, you know, all sorts of different people. By the way, this is the Biden's regime's numbers. 130 people on the terror watch list that have just scampered across the border. They could be in Orlando. They could be in Dallas. They could be in San Francisco. And those sleeper cells could be activated at any moment. And I don't do that as a way to try to scare you. It's just a fact that if this stuff really heats up in the Middle East, they could activate a series of people that actually hate us. And if you want to go a step further, the one thing that we actually should have fixed after 9/11, it was not making it harder to get on an airplane so you have to have a can't have a water bottle, right? Which is TSA is one of the, in my opinion, one of the worst overreactions to a tragedy. The TSA doesn't make anybody safer. It makes everybody angrier. It makes travel sloppier. And it created like this whole new like post office style bureaucracy. And some of them are really nice people. And some of them should honestly be working nowhere. It's like so slow. And by the way, I don't know what it is about Orlando. You guys have the worst TSA situation. It's unbelievable. I mean, I think I've traveled 3,100 days in the last 10 years, so I can say this. I've literally every airport in the country, I know the code, MCO. And I think I've wasted like 15 hours in a TSA line at Orlando. It's not an exaggeration. I mean, it's unbelievable. But anyway, did that make us safer? You know what would have made us safer? If we would have said, wait a second, 9/11 was somewhat of an intelligence failure, but it was mostly an immigration failure. We didn't have the courage to say that. That we allowed people into the country that hated us. That we did not screen. That we did not know who they were. The one takeaway that actually would make us safer from 9/11, we refused to actually do. We did all the wrong stuff. We like built this massive spy agency on Americans that are now being used against right-wingers. We have the Department of Homeland Security that, again, has the TSA underneath it. And so when it talks about immigration, my ideal immigration situation is not going to be implemented anytime soon. But if we have some change at leadership, maybe that could happen, which is your country will cease to exist if you keep on bringing people in that don't share your core values, fail to assimilate, and in fact have resentment for your core values. And we have to have the courage to say that. And when someone calls you a racist, tell them to go to hell and say it again. And say that when you as a country keep on bringing people that don't share your values, your country will cease to exist, period. And I'm going to focus on, you know, the mascot of all this, which is Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar is basically the poster child of an ingrate. And an ingrate, I know some people that actually don't know what that word means. It just means ingratitude. Okay, don't get too excited. I'm not talking about her suspicious relationship with her brother, any of that stuff, okay? I'm not getting into that. I definitely wouldn't mention that. I'm talking about how she's an ingrate, okay? Just being very clear. Gratitude is what every university should produce, and we get the opposite. We get ingratitude. Remember, if you complain more than you produce, you're on the left. And people that do that end up being ungrateful. Ilhan Omar, rescued in a Kenyan refugee camp by Americans, war-torn Somalia, comes to America, does not assimilate, right? Goes into very, very radical circles, mini Mogadishu, which is in Minneapolis, Somali communities. They've taken over almost all of Minneapolis now. It's really sad. And she runs for Congress, and then she comes to Congress, and one of her first tweets, speeches, you know, collection of them, is about how America is systemically racist. And I think that's repulsive. First of all, it's a lie. And I'm like, excuse me, madam? Like, we're so racist we rescued you from a Kenyan refugee camp? And now you're a member of Congress? Like, go back to Mogadishu, honestly. I mean that. That's where she should represent. And she has nothing but mean-spiritedness towards us as Americans. And every other time she gets on, it's always destabilizing the country. It's never about, you know what? What a beautiful place. Maybe I should check my pride and my ego and have a little gratitude for Western society that was nice enough to come to a Kenyan refugee camp and lift me out from the third world into the top of the first world. I don't get that from her, ever. Instead, it's always about, and Rashida Tlaib, born in America, talks exactly the same. But Ilhan Omar's story is just so shocking. And at that, and the past couple of years, it's been more and more clarifying for me, which is that this, the immigration situation, which ties into what's going on with Israel somewhat, but more broadly, this is the unsustainable ingredient. People say, Charlie, America, will it continue? Not if we keep on bringing people into the country that hate us. It will not. You cannot, because then some people say, you know, well, we can win them over and, you know, they will liberalize and eventually they'll be wearing like Levi jeans. Like, again, Ilhan Omar, it's not working, right? She's wearing the head garb, whole deal. Like, here's a provocative question. Has American culture impacted Ilhan Omar more, or has Ilhan Omar impacted American culture more? Because we used to believe our culture is so strong we can change anybody. No, it's not true. It's strong to change some people that are willing to change. When immigrants came in the 1920s or 30s, they learned the language. They assimilated to the country. They wanted to be part of a bigger project. Now, when some groups come to the country, they're like, no, I'm going to keep on speaking my native language. I'm not going to assimilate, and I don't have resentment for this place. There's an interview that was aired on, you know, Fox. This guy was going back and forth, this young lady, full mask on, not a Fauci mask, like a, you know, the Taliban type mask. And she, I'm not kidding, it's what it is. And the guy said, do you want to put America first? She's like, why would I want to put America first? And he says, well, are you a U.S. passport holder? She's like, of course I am. And it's like that, and I hate to put it this way because it's so cruel. I mean, it's the suicide of the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. You cannot have an active insurgency, all the while, by the way, filled simultaneously with us training our young to hate the country. And they kind of meet in the middle, and they're like, we've been waiting for each other, right? The 20-year-old white woke, you know, kid from Boca Raton that's never worked an honest day in his life who thinks he's figured everything out because, you know, he read Karl Marx and he wants to take other people's stuff because he's a lazy bum. And, you know, the 25-year-old from Mogadishu, they're like, I've been waiting for you. Together, we can destroy the great Satan. And we must stop them. That's what we stand for. A lot more than that. But honestly, we must draw the line in the sand and say, honestly, if you have resentment, bitterness, rage, anger for this nation, like, you shouldn't be anywhere near political power. You shouldn't be in charge of anything. We have to multiply our numbers to find the people that are thankful to be here, despite our political differences, and to keep on persuading where necessary, building coalitions, because I want this country to continue. I want this country to survive. And one of the reasons why we do not actually do what is necessary and what is right is because we're afraid of the names that people call us. And yeah, they call you a racist. Great. Means nothing. They're doing it jokingly, but somebody might actually, maybe you're not, I don't know, who cares. It doesn't mean anything. If you will change your language based on somebody calling you a name, you have never graduated third grade. And think about, some of you probably are like, boy, I actually do change my language because of name calling. I could lose my job. Yeah, you could lose your job. I could get kicked out of class. Yeah, could. Yeah, there's high stakes for this. I get it. There is. But the country's worth more than kowtowing to people that have never built anything, that are filled with resentment, who call you names because they want you to bend a knee to their agenda. And one of the reasons why, you know, it's so well attended here tonight is that there actually are more of us than them. We just have to start speaking out. There are great people in this country. And our courage is growing. And our resolve is intensifying. And we care less and less about the name calling. And we're finding more allies. And we're supporting the good guys. And we're starting Turning Point USA chapters all across the country to fight back against this nonsense. So, and that's what gives me hope, is I'm starting to see people finally start to rise up and fight for what is right.
Strong Cell is amazing. I got to tell you, the combination of NADH, CoQ10, and collagen is really something. You know, people ask me, they say, Charlie, how do you keep your energy up? How do you just keep on pushing? Look, part of it is diet, nutrition, but I'll be honest, I take supplements really seriously. Fact check me on this. You can say, oh, Charlie, I'm going to fact check you. Type this into your search engine. NADH. H-E-D-H. Just type it in. What does it tell you? It might tell you that it is the secret to living long, anti-aging properties, more energy. Well, all of that is being proven in more and more clinical trials. NADH is a precursor so that your mitochondria can remain healthy and vibrant. The elites, a lot of billionaires, people with a lot of money, they spend a ton of money on NAD. It's a fact. NAD just might be your secret weapon for more energy. I take NAD every single day. I could tell you that NADH compared with CoQ10, the trials show very, very good things. I know, don't take my word for it. I mean, honestly, my word should be good for something, but fact check me. Look at it. And if you do it over 30 days, you'll see an increase in energy. I wake up better than ever before. NAD can help you potentially, again, fact check me on this, with depression, anxiety, other issues that you might be dealing with. It is nature's gift to you so that you might have extra energy and mental clarity. You guys can use promo code CHARLIE for 20% off. It's strongcell.com/CHARLIE. NAD might be nature's secret weapon for you. I love it. I take it every single day. Try it for at least 30 days to see the maximum benefit. And let me know, has NAD helped your life? Strongcell.com/CHARLIE. Check it out. Strongcell.com/CHARLIE.
Okay, let's do some questions, everybody. Not raising hands. We're just going to have you guys line up. And where are we doing it? Right, left, in between? All right, let me tell you the ground rules. A couple things. If you very eager. So, a couple things. If you disagree, you can go to the front of the line. Our team will talk to you. Yeah, you're very eager to disagree. Great. So, one sec. So this is a predominantly conservative audience. If a liberal shows up to ask a question and you find it laughable or you find it whatever, don't boo, don't mock. Give them the respect that liberals never give us, okay? Yeah. I still believe in freedom of speech, and that means the freedom to be heard. And for any liberals that are here tonight, I want you to just file this away. You might be unconvinced by anything I say, but maybe this will all of a sudden bloom into a flower of enlightenment later in your life. When a liberal comes and speaks on campus, do they invite the conservatives who disagree to the front of the line for over an hour to hear, to say whatever they want to say? And with that, let's do the first question.
Hey, I'm Matthew Mountford. I'm the president of the Orlando Activism Hub.
Awesome.
And what I'm wondering for you is what prompted you to start Turning Point USA?
Boy, honestly, I was 18 years old at the time. I was going to go to West Point, didn't get in. Took a gap year. It's been 11 gap years, and it's highly recommended. I'm actually turning 30 on Saturday. It's a real midlife crisis. It's crazy. So it's like, I can't believe we made it this long. No, at the pace that I've been going, it's you want to break your neck or back, travel 3,200 days in a decade, 1,000,000 miles on every airline, been to 20 countries, done all sorts of crazy things, been super blessed. But yeah, honestly, I was motivated at the time and I'm motivated now. I don't sit idly by when evil is on the march. It's that simple. I don't like bullies. I don't like evil. I hate evil, actually. Psalm 97:10 is really my life verse. If you love God, you must hate evil. And that is really kind of what I do, what I do. And I love the Lord. I'm obedient to him to the best I can. We all fall. We all stumble. But my life's work is about fighting evil. I think Christians, conservatives, whatever you, I'm a Christian, but if you're a conservative, we've done a very poor job at fighting evil. It's everywhere. It's abundant. It's platformed. And that's why I started Turning Point. And honestly, it's why I try to rise up a generation of young people to speak the truth against all the nonsense in our country. God bless you, man. Thank you. And thanks for your involvement.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ivy. I am the Daytona State College chapter president.
Awesome.
For Turning Point USA.
Great. Not too
and
far of a
kind
drive.
Kind of to piggyback off of what you were just saying, when I became a girl mom, my whole world perspective and biblical perspective changed. How has, since you've become a girl dad, how has that changed your mindset and the way you view things, especially having a little daughter to take care of now?
It changes everything. And I mean this, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but that's why I'm here, right? So I take the complaints of the childless less seriously.
Yeah.
That's not to say if you don't have children, I don't respect you. But if you're very, very, very opinionated, mm-hmm. and you've never had to raise a child, I kind of say, listen, you're missing a big element of who we are as a species.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, there's some amazing people that have not been blessed to have children, and they've been incredibly obedient to God, and they've built beautiful lives. And so look, there's exceptions to everything, right? But let's be honest. The exception is not governing the country, right? The exception right now is childless people that are running our politics. And the childless fundamentally are running the American left right now.
Yeah.
The number one most vocal group are childless young women who are in their 30s with cats.
Absolutely.
They're militant. They have college degrees. They're partners at Deloitte. But yeah, they ignored their biological urge to go have children. Guess what? Like, a lot of these young ladies, if you actually got them to tell the truth, they're probably filled with a lot of regret.
Yeah, I would say so too.
And they wish and they hope, and maybe if they pray, but a lot of them don't believe in God, that they could have children. And I mean this like non-sarcastically. It's a profoundly sad state of political affairs in this country.
Yeah.
I'm sad for them because I have a daughter, and that's one of the greatest, coolest blessings ever. That it's not about me and that you get to actually serve somebody else.
Yeah.
Not to mention marriage, which is like the coolest thing ever. But we've told young women, go pursue your career. Go get the piece of paper. Maybe. Maybe. And then don't complain when you're 33 and you say all the good ones are gone. You take a risk. You're playing Russian roulette with your biological future if you put your career first. And every young woman, more than young men, it's just the way it is. I'm sorry. Young men can wait longer. Sorry. It's not fair. Every young lady has to sit seriously tonight and decide, and it's not always this way. You can maybe have both. Some people can, some people can't. But you have to rank one more than the other. Great career, great family.
Yeah.
And that should govern almost every major decision you make. And that's not to say you can't try to have both, but that's a very important decision to make at a young age.
Agreed.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you
so much. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Liam Borg. I'm a proud member of the Young Democratic Socialists of America on campus. I'm expecting booze from that. I don't mind.
No, you're around conservatives, so.
Also, for the record, not that it matters, but if I were to host an event on campus, I'd be more than happy to have people disagree with me to come first. Unfortunately, I do not get to host events. I wish. First off, I wanted to just make a small factual correction to something that you said, which is about the 130 migrants on the terror list that have crossed the border. The actual number is 160, and those were numbers that had been stopped at the border, meaning they were prevented from entering, which means that these people were stopped during the Biden administration.
Right. So you're not exactly strengthening your argument. It's actually higher. Thank you. And so how many gotaways have there been at the border this year?
Say that again, sorry.
Gotaways, people that weren't tracked that we don't know that came into the interior?
Unfortunately, that's kind of hard to track, as you said. However, that's actually, I just wanted to—
Yeah, it's about 500,000 minimum.
Wow, okay.
Yeah,
I just wanted
wow.
to give you that number, though, just so that you're aware. But that's actually not my question, my point, I guess. My point was about Palestine. You
what?
Mentioned—
What country
Palestine.
Is that? Oh, okay, where is that?
In the Middle East.
Wait, is it in Judea and Samaria?
I'm sorry, say that again. I can't hear you.
What country are you talking about?
Palestine.
It exists?
Yes.
Oh.
In fact, it existed before the current Israel.
Oh, really?
Yes.
According to who?
According to history books.
Oh, okay. So wait, you mean Judea and Samaria, the rightful homeland of the Jews that they call the West Bank and they're currently occupying?
If you're going by religion, sure. I personally don't go by religion.
Oh, what do you go by then? Where the Arabs want to occupy?
Logic.
Oh,
and
really?
History.
So whose is Gaza?
Gaza's location within Palestine, but I'd like to go on to my point, if you will. Currently, Israel is actually being labeled by international human rights organizations such as Amnesty International as an apartheid state because they are attacking many people from within Palestine, and they have been actually – the land has been stolen from Palestine. Not to say that the people in Israel do not deserve their own land. I am a believer in a two-state solution. I want to make that clear. And I also want to make clear that I do not agree with the recent incidents because there is no excuse for harming civilians. However, I do want to
Good.
Make
You're morally
point.
Clear on that. Good.
Thank you. I do want to make clear that also Israel has captured more than 228 Palestinian children, in which they held in containment. And of these, 86% were beaten. Oh, and these were, by the way, the 220 is only those that were able to be surveyed. So they were recovered. The 86% of those were beaten in detention, 69% were strip searched, and 42% were injured at the point of arrest. Additionally, I would like to add, due to your claim about dictators, that Benjamin Netanyahu has been in power since 2009, and he also held in power since from 1996 to 1999.
There's actually a moment when he wasn't prime minister.
Naftali Bennett was actually,
and he's duly elected. When was the last time Abbas won an election?
Say that again?
When was the last time Mahmoud Abbas won an election?
That I do currently not have.
Yeah, 8 years. They don't hold elections because they're under a dictatorship. I'm just curious because I want to try to find some clarity more than agreement because we're not going to find agreement. If Israel stopped fighting, what would happen? If they laid down all their guns tomorrow, what would happen?
I personally can't say. I'm not in charge of any of the leadership.
Yes, so all the Jews would be killed. If Hamas
it's
laid
not
down
about Judaism, though.
If
Israel's actually the ones that have taken Palestine's land,
okay,
and are
again,
killing people
I'm just
Palestine.
Trying to find some moral clarity. If Hamas laid down all of their weapons, what would we have?
There would be no more Palestine.
Peace is what we would have.
No, that's
we would have peace.
Excuse my language, but that's and you
okay.
Know
so
it.
Let me ask this: why did Israel give Gaza back to the Arab Muslims for peace? Why did they
then
give
the they
Sinai to
Gaza?
Egypt for
why
peace?
Did they throw missiles over there.
No, hold on a second. Why did they give the Sinai to Egypt? For peace. Why did they give the Gaza Strip to the Palestinian Authority? For peace. Well, in Hamas's charter, what does it say?
I'm not defending Hamas.
Hold on a second. Right. You're defending the Palestinian Authority, which is partners with Hamas, and they duly elected them.
No. I'm not defending that either.
Hamas's charter any different than Nazi Germany's charter towards the Jews?
I'm not defending any of that. And for one—
So what are you defending exactly?
For one, I'm defending the right of Palestine to exist, which— I want to clarify, I am not telling you that you're being Islamophobic by supporting Israel. I'm not telling you that you want to kill the Muslims. So trying to say that the existence of Palestine
here's a fact. Let me
is
tell you.
Anti-Semitic
Let me tell you. I think this last
ridiculous.
Weekend displayed the holes in your argument. When Jews go for their high holy day, Arabs come in and kill Jews. When Arabs want to have peace, the Jews will come to the table for a peace agreement. Abraham Accords, the Oslo Accords. Any time that the Arabs want to talk, the Jews will come to the table to talk in the pursuit of peace. Meanwhile, this weekend, in a slight vulnerability, what happened? Jews are celebrating the end of Yom Kippur, the reading of the Torah, and they come in and they kill 900 Jews. And answer me this. If this was an isolated incident, why were they greeted as heroes by the people of Gaza after they killed 900 women and children?
I want to make this clear once more because you seem to not be understanding. I am not defending these actions. I am simply refuting the claims that you made earlier in this argument.
Here's the thing. I think a two-state solution sounds great if you don't actually live in reality. Let me tell you what reality is. The Arabs don't want to govern their own people. They would rather hate Jews. Every day, they're saying death to the Jews, kill the Jews. They do not want to govern their own people. There is no middle ground when they have, they're screaming to the sky for Antifada. Israel has been at the table time and time again. Do you agree? Abraham Accords, trying to find peace, trying to sit down with Mahmoud Abbas.
The Israelites have hundreds of Palestinian children in detention. They have sent missiles to Palestine and killed hundreds of civilians. After this event, Netanyahu declared that he will send missiles to Palestine in an area where the Palestinian civilians are not able to leave.
Wait, hold on a second. You mean to Gaza?
Yes.
Right, where they actually gave warnings to apartment buildings. What kind of
they
Israel's
can't
so
leave
bad
Gaza.
That they tell people
they
to leave before they bomb them? Hamas comes on a holy day into kibbutzes and cuts women's heads off. At concerts. The moral equivalence is so different. And let me just ask you, what do you think is a bigger impediment to peace, Hamas or Israel?
If you would like, I'd prefer if you could stop interrupting me.
I'm the speaker, you're not. So let me just remind you, you're a college kid, you came to our event. So let me just ask you a very clear question. Bigger impediment to peace, Palestinian Authority or Israel?
Israel.
Prove it.
Israel.
Tell me one situation where Israel has not come to the table. Israel has given up land. When was the last time the Palestinian Authority willingly gave up land for peace?
Israel's bombing
never,
the land
because they don't
up.
Want peace. They want dead Jews. And we as Americans should never put up with the intentional extermination of Jews again in our country. Thanks for being here. Thank you.
Israel.
Sir.
Thank you. We're going to the next question.
I argue that when you have these debates,
we're going
America,
to the next question. Thank you.
About race.
Thank
so
you.
Why is it about it there?
We're going to take the next question. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is closeted Jew hatred laundered through Arab talking points.
Hey, everybody. Charlie Kirk here. And like many of you, I'm a busy guy balancing family, show, travel, and TP USA. When I needed a mortgage, I went to my friends Andrew Delray and Todd Avakian at Sierra Pacific. They were amazing. And look, I had some complicated stuff. Don't need to go into the details. They handled it personally. Call them if you have an aging family member, for example, that needs some financial relief. Ask them about a reverse mortgage. If you're self-employed and are finding it difficult to qualify because of that, they have my 100% full and complete endorsement. Call them and help you prepare. I'm telling you, anything mortgage related, please call them and not the big woke banks. Go to andrewandtodd.com. That's andrewandtodd.com. Fill out the quick form and they will get back to you with answers. Call them at 888-888-1172, andrewandtodd.com. They're good friends of mine. Full and complete endorsement. If you are a first-time home buyer renting and want to be, they'll call and help you prepare. Check it out, andrewandtodd.com. That is andrewandtodd.com. Fill out the quick form, and they'll get you back with answers, andrewandtodd.com.
Hi, Charlie. Jonathan Arlo, nice to meet you. So I do have massive disagreements with you, but I do want to thank you for coming and speaking with us because I don't agree with people trying to silence you from speaking. I don't think that's right. So thank you for coming and speaking with us. I don't really understand this idea that President Trump is anti-establishment because I think his record shows that he's actually really establishment. So just a couple examples, like he took Barack Obama's drone strikes, which had a 90% civilian casualty rate. And, you know, it was a bunch of war crimes that Barack Obama committed with that, killed innocent civilians and everything. Trump took that and he increased Obama's drone strikes by 432%. And even his first raid as president, the raid in Yemen killed an 8-year-old American girl. And like another example, he filled his cabinet with like war hawks like John Bolton, who's never met a war he didn't like.
That's true.
Swampy people like Alexander Acosta, who he was literally the guy that like brokered the sweetheart deal for Jeffrey Epstein. So I don't get the – and even his voting record, like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer – they voted with him like 78% of the time. Liz Cheney voted 90%.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Let me challenge you because there's a pretty obvious point here. If he was not anti-establishment, why does the establishment try to put him in prison for 500 years?
So
hold on a second.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, on this drone thing, yeah, he might have continued drone programs. Did he not try to end the Afghan war? In fact, he was the only one in the room trying to end the war in Afghanistan. And finally, if he was pro-establishment, how many new wars were started under Donald Trump?
Well, so for the establishment trying to lock him up, I do think there's legitimate crimes there. We can disagree on that. But I do agree that the establishment...
We're definitely going to disagree on that.
I do agree that the establishment, it is a politically motivated thing because... I think if he decided not to run, they wouldn't be going after him. So I do think it's political, but I don't think it changes the fact that those are legitimate crimes. But I don't think the establishment is scared of his, like, how he would govern. What the establishment hates more about Donald Trump is that, like, he, whenever he's, like, running for president, he exposes the corruption in the establishment, and he has a way of making it seem like he's not part of them while playing the game while governing. So I don't think they're so scared.
Okay,
of his
so let's
record.
Talk about three policy issues.
Yes.
What is the establishment regime position on trade?
The establishment
unlimited amount of trade, foreign products coming in, free trade. What was Trump's position? Tariffs on China.
Yeah.
Right. Renegotiating NAFTA. What is the establishment position on global type contracts? For example, Paris Peace Treaty. Trump got out of it. Right. Blew up all this stuff at the UN. How about another issue? Immigration. What is the regime standard position on immigration? Invade the world, invite the world, as many people as possible. Trump put a travel ban on from China and had a terror watch list ban for any country in the Middle East. So I could go position by position, not to mention, you know, look at Trump fired Comey. Yeah, you agree with that one?
Yeah, but
what kind of establishment guy fires the head of the FBI and then has to experience a 2-year investigation launched by Mueller? Well, which was
and
complete
I think that investigation was BS too. But he put in Christopher Wray. Christopher Wray right now was protecting the Biden administration.
Fair enough. So that's a fair point.
He puts in establishment people.
So your argument is purely on personnel. And let me just say this. Donald Trump, as Rush Limbaugh would say, selects personnel that is perplexing at times. But what I think you will agree with is that his instincts and many of his major policy actions were generationally and transformationally against the regime establishment of the last 40 years in both political parties. And whether it be war, immigration, trade, international type agreements. And understand, he was the only one that was fighting, and these people would come in and they'd lie to him. I'm going to be an FBI director with this. And he will be the first one to say, should have handled Fauci differently, should have handled Birx differently. But you know what? If you want to see Donald Trump unleashed, wait for term two Donald Trump to be able to go after the administrative state. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Thank you. That was a constructive conversation. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Nicolas Camacho, and you can just call me Nick. I just want to start by saying that I am neither inclined to the left or inclined to the right, and I just want to say that I don't necessarily always agree with everything that you say, but I do appreciate and really like your passion and dedication to making Americans be happy to be American, to be supportive of America, and to want to better America in every way possible. And my question for you today is, would you consider it unfair for individuals of any political leaning to point out injustices and wrongdoings and failures of their opponents without the failures and shortcomings of ourselves first?
That's generally probably a good rule.
Okay. I think that's it. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, for example, I criticize the Republican Party more than I criticize the Democrats. Okay. And anyone who follows me knows that to be the case, right? One of the main reasons we are in the mess that we're in is we do not have an opposition party in this country. Is that we have a uniparty type consensus that keeps the borders open, that is hungry to try to get us in another stupid war with Ukraine and Russia, which I think is one of the dumbest things we could possibly do while our own border is open. And so my criticism goes more towards people that wear the Republican jersey than the Democrat jersey, actually.
My second part of that question is also, how, in your professional opinion, do you think would be best for people of all colors, creeds, religions, political ideologies, and anything else come together to truly discuss and try to make furtherment? Because right now it's just a back and forth. It's just a tit for tat, and we're getting really nowhere.
Yeah, and we're not going to get anywhere, honestly. And, I mean, there's plenty of things you can fault the American right for. Not embracing speech is not one of them. I mean, look at this event. We want the discourse. We want the dialogue. We want the disagreement. We'll actively go on their shows and their podcasts. But look, I hate to have some unfortunate news. We don't have differences of opinion with a lot of leftists. We have differences of morals. And we have differences of worldview. And that is a very, very sad truth, and it's very hard to reconcile. I'll prove it to you. Marxists want the destruction of the American Constitution. I think it's the greatest political document ever written. They want borders open. I want the border closed. They think that, you know, trans surgeries for kids, aka chemical castration, is acceptable. I think it's modern day medieval butchery, and anyone who does that should be put in prison for the rest of their life. What I'm getting at is, I don't quite know how to reconcile that. So speech is the only way I can think of. Thank you. Appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm seeing how much I have to lean in. Hi, how's it going, Mr.
Good.
Kirk? I have a disagreement about the whole Palestine-Israel thing. I promise not to take up as much time as the last person who was up here. But I'd like to open with a little statement, which is that, you know, I'm not too partial to either particular side of the political spectrum. But I think that a sad reality is when we talk about the Palestine issue, it's the Gaza Strip is 50% people under the age of 15. It's about 2 million people and about 5 to 25 square miles. And the reality of it is that Israel has said they're going to make a complete siege of the area. They've cut off electricity. They've cut off water. And that's kind of a sad reality. And the reality is they also can't leave. There's only two ports of entry and exit. And so as much as you or others might be pro-Israel, how do we not condemn the Israelis for taking away resources like water from a population that's the majority children? And at what point do we say that it's kind of an open genocide, right? Like, when Israel. On. Well, I mean, I know it's easy to.
You realize on Saturday they killed 900 Jews,
I'm not,
right?
I mean, I understand.
One side's doing the genocide; the other side is retaliating.
Well, one side's definitely swinging up, and one side's swinging down. And I think that when you're a strip of land at which all of your water, airways, and electricity is controlled by a state. Which you can't leave, and it gets bombed by missiles. I don't really think it's quite equivocal. I mean, obviously, everyone here can condemn the killing of civilians, and that's not a debate that I'm going to have with anybody, left or right.
Sure.
But at what point in time, you know, you say you criticize Republicans, but why don't we ever criticize Israel for what they're doing by turning off water? I mean, how?
Let me just ask a hypothetical. If Cuba came to Miami and killed 50,000 Americans, should we cut off their water? Answer the question.
Absolutely not.
Okay, I disagree.
You think we should cut off water to people?
If the Cuban government came and killed 50,000 Americans, which is the population equivalent, right?
Sure.
So 900 Jews would be 50,000 Americans.
Yeah.
I would completely support war against a country that kills 50,000 Americans. Cuba is the same, about similar distance, right? So yes, I would restrict food, water. It would be all out war against a country that touched our homeland.
Well, you know what they call all-out war against a populace of people that are stuck in an area. It's a genocide, right? And so as much as I
agree— No, hold on a second. No. First of all, if that was the case, why is Israel telling civilians to leave a certain area, number one?
Well, only that are allowed to leave, right?
Wait, I'm sorry, what?
Like, are Palestinians allowed to leave the Gaza Strip?
Well, they're moving to a different location of the Gaza Strip before bombardments happen. That's number one. Number two, they're already talking about humanitarian corridors being built. Did you know that? They're talking about humanitarian corridors being built with Egypt. So there's already a plan from both the Mediterranean side and the South side. But honestly, I'm not going to overly specify this because war is a really brutal, nasty thing. And you could say whatever you want about Israel. We're not going to agree on it, right?
Sure.
Israel did not invite this war.
No, I don't think so either.
Right, but they have to retaliate. And war is the worst thing humans do. Here's my prayer that Israel doesn't overreact. Americans don't send troops, and that this is short, and that the terrorists that did this are held to justice. That's what we need to publicly say. But I am not. And you're right. There are kids that are going to die. That pains me. The heaviness should be on you. But the answer is you just kind of roll over and allow people to come into your country, into kibbutzes, into concerts, and mowing down people and say, you know, catch you next time.
I'm just not entirely sure what water has to do with the conflict, Mr. Kirk. I just don't see how the Israelis,
it's
the Palestinians,
war.
The PLO,
and
Hamas
honestly,
can use water.
Two things. Here's the issue. The Palestinian Authority is too busy spending $300 million a year incentivizing the slaying of Jews instead of actually going and purchasing water filtration services, you know, all sorts of different things there. Number two, so they build their headquarters under hospitals. It's a fact.
Uh-huh.
They use the entire population of women and children in Gaza as a massive 2.5 million person human shield. That's sick. There are no good solutions here. There's not one that I'm going to say this is wonderful and beautiful and glamorous and this is excellent. It's all crummy. It's all hell. And they invited hell. And something that we like to gloss over as Westerners is we get to live in a very peaceful society, relatively, and we don't realize that sometimes you need a Dresden. And that's a really hard thing to swallow. But guess what? What we did in World War II to defeat the Nazis was 100% morally defensible. And there were people that also died. Israel has a right to defend themselves, and they're going to retaliate. And Hamas, they brought this upon themselves. They were the stewards of those women and children. And as stewards of those women and children, they said, we don't care about the women and children enough that we're going to go into the other. They knew what was. You're trying to tell me that they're shocked that they're getting bombarded and their water's cut off and their electricity is cut? No, they invited it. Final thought.
Sure. I wouldn't necessarily say they, but I do understand the sentiment, right?
Okay.
I do agree that Hamas brings it upon themselves.
But I think we can agree. Here's what I will say. I do not think U.S. troops outside of very specific special forces to rescue Americans, which I'm sure you might be able to agree with, should be involved in this conflict.
Yeah.
We cannot allow ourselves to get into another Middle Eastern quagmire that Lindsey Graham and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence might try to get us into. That is something we can agree with. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Charlie. This is David Weissman, a UCF student and Occupy Democrats writer. I just want to say thank you for support of Israel. I actually have family there. But however, my question is, while you show support for Israel, condemn the anti-Semitism on the far left and radical Islam. How can we ignore the anti-Semitism in the own Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's in the Republican Party. I mean, it's so funny. I get different questions. Some people say that the Republican Party is too pro-Israel, and other people say that it's, you know, not pro-Israel enough. Just recently at an event with Dennis Prager, somebody came up and I asked them, because they were saying some rather suspicious things, I said, do you want a holy war against the Jews? And they refused to answer, and we treated them appropriately. I denounce Jew hatred in any form or fashion, whether it's on the right or left.
And thank you. And just one quick question if I have time. While you show support for Israel, how come it's a sin for showing support or aid for Ukraine? You know, from the
Oh, that's a good question. That's actually a really good question. So two totally different situations. Number one, when it comes to the attack, when Russia invaded Ukraine, not morally justifiable, they went for military targets, first and foremost. Were there civilians killed? Yes, there were also civilians killed. But their intent has been throughout to kill military targets in the theater of war. Hamas did something completely different. They went on a murder spree intentionally of civilians and women throughout all of that. Number two, I think we must look at this completely different, you know, from geopolitics. I don't think that we should try to antagonize Russia. I just don't. I think that Russia being a neutral hedge against China, as Donald Trump had them, is a very smart geopolitical position. And trying to create an enemy out of Russia makes little to no sense. But actually, my position is actually very similar. I think no U.S. troops in Ukraine, no U.S. troops in Israel. So it's actually pretty consistent. But if you're going to ask me where I am more likely to morally cheerlead, yeah, it's the country that just had 900 of their people, which is a 50,000 person equivalent, literally slayed in the streets, slayed in a concert. And I will say this, I believe that as a Christian, I have a moral obligation to protect the holy sites and access to the archaeological digs in the Holy Land. One of the main reasons why I support Israel, and this is not going to be persuasive to everybody, is that being able to prove that the Bible is true is a very important thing as a Christian. There is a nonstop war to destabilize and deconstruct the holy word of God. There has never been an archaeological discovery in Israel that has disproven the Bible. There is a lot of evidence that shows that when Arabs take over holy sites, they do not allow Christians to go to them. And I'll prove it to you. It's very hard for Christians to go to the birthplace of Christ, Bethlehem. It's controlled completely by Arab Muslims. It's very dangerous. You could still go, but it's not easy. I think it would be a tragedy that I will not be able to bring my daughter to the Garden Tomb or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or the Mount of Olives or the Mount of Beatitudes. So they're two separate things. I think that Israel plays a very important role in Western civilization and especially me as a Christian as well. Do you have a response? Yeah.
Oh, no. I thank you for answering the question.
Thank you, man. Thanks for being here tonight. Appreciate it. Hey, everybody. Charlie Kirk here. As you know, following this week's horrible events, Israel is at war. The people of Israel are under attack from brutal terrorists targeting innocent civilians, including women and children. There's over 1,000 casualties, as well as kidnapping and infiltration of southern Israeli towns. Israel is now retaliating and could escalate with a ground offensive against Hamas militants. The situation is critical, which is why I'm partnering with our friends at the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews to rush emergency relief to the hardest hit areas. Call the special phone number 800-492-5454 to make an emergency donation. Again, that's 800-492-5454. Your emergency gift will help the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews save lives and provide critical essentials needed right now. During this dark time, the need in war-torn areas will be tremendous. The fellowship has extensive network of staff, partner organizations, and more. Immediately respond with life-saving security and support measures. We ask all people to pray for safety and protection. Call 800-235-887 as we rush urgent need right now to help Israel through the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews.
Hello, Mr. Kirk. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Autumn Brookman, and I just wrote this novel called 2034. It's a modern take of 1984. Before I ask my question, could I give this to you?
Yeah, sure. Right. Okay. Well, okay, sure. Great. A cautionary tale. Very good. I'm sure I will enjoy it. Yes, your question.
Yeah. So I just wanted to ask your advice. You know, as someone who's starting, I value what you're doing, spreading the truth and encouraging others to speak, of just how to make that connection, you know, sharing a message and how to connect with an audience.
Well, I want to compliment you. You're already doing the first thing. You know, ask for what you want, right? Be bold. And, you know, when I first started Turning Point USA, I can't tell you how many groups I would go to try to give up my business card and meet people, and 99% of them didn't want to talk to me, right? But it's the 1% that will take you seriously, that you really connect with, and you follow up with a coffee and you follow up with a dinner. You have to hustle. you have to scrap. You know, you really have to try to, you know, inch towards what you want. And it looks like you're already doing a pretty good job of that. And outwork your competition. That's the other thing. Put in more hours than the person you're competing against. There's things you can control and things you can't control. You can control how hard you work. And what I have found, it's not a perfect line through, but the people that dedicate themselves through putting more hours into something, real serious hours, tend to do very well over 1 year, 5 year, 10 years of whatever they try to do. Thank you so much. Appreciate
Thank
it. Thank you. Since I started late, we'll go late. Is that okay with you guys? Is that all right? Okay. And if you disagree, our team will find you. And yes, sir.
Hello. First, I wanted to thank you for being here, and I apologize. This question is not as well worded as it could be.
That's okay.
But like, how do you recommend students, particularly at UC, or conservative students who face discrimination? How do you recommend students who face discrimination for their conservative views, respond on campus? Specifically, I personally, I've been banned from two of my classes' student-made group chats. One instance, I was banned for sending the link to this event, and the other instance, we were planning a study group and discussing at what times everyone was free, and I responded by saying, oh, we all live in America, we're free all the time, which resulted in a ban. So one of the students took it so far to report me to our professor for discrimination, and my professors thought that was bullshit. And now these same kids that I was studying with for the past 6 weeks, and we were completely fine with no problems. These same kids are now calling me the same words that you said earlier: a bigot, a fascist, racist, and stuff like that. How would you recommend I go about responding to them besides just ignoring them?
So how many of you feel as if you're treated differently because of conservative or Christian views on campus, on this campus? Yeah, that's chilling. That's where your taxpayer dollars in Florida are going. Basically, every hand goes up. For donors out there, please stop giving money to colleges, okay? You're subsidizing conservative hatred. Just look at it right here, okay? Stop giving money to colleges. So look, this problem's not going to go away. You might say, oh, it's just bad on campus. Well, if you go get a job at Goldman Sachs, that problem will follow you there. If you go get a job at, you know, Morgan Stanley or whatever you want to do in life, right? You have to make a decision early on, and I don't know what the right answer for you is because there's a cost to everything in life.
Absolutely.
But you have to make a decision whether I'm okay pretending to be somebody that I'm not and saying things I don't believe if it means that I will have an easier career. So, you know, Ben Shapiro and I disagree on this, okay? I have Ben Shapiro coming on our show tomorrow. And Ben would say, hey, in college, just do what the professor wants you to do. Kind of keep your head down and get the grade.
Which is, I'm sure, most of us do here.
Yeah. And so that's Ben's position. And Ben went to Harvard. I didn't. I went nowhere, right? Well, not nowhere, but yeah. So, yeah. But Ben has a different perspective because credentials for him matter a lot. And honestly, he's very successful. I have a different view and I've built a life around it, but it's not been an easy life. But it's been a deep one and a fulfilling one and a purposeful one.
Absolutely.
Which is that when I was in high school, I made a decision that if I see something that I know is a lie, I'm going to do the best I can to correct it with truth. And if you live by that, you will live a better life. It will be incredibly difficult.
Absolutely.
You'll be called names. But I don't have to. I then created a life for myself unintentionally where I can be the same person in private that I am in public. There's no hidden person, right?
Understood.
And, you know, to a certain extent, the number one, you know, I get thousands of emails a day and I do my best to read all of them. And the email that I get more than anything else is, Charlie, love the show, love Turning Point USA. You know, I'm a $50 a month donor. God bless you. Keep it up. I'm really worried that my boss is going to find out that I have conservative views. You know, what do I do? And for those of you, I never visited the Soviet Union, but something that marks me, obviously I wasn't alive, but if you read the literature of people that visited the Soviet Union, there was a characteristic that pervaded totalitarian, tyrannical countries, where anytime you were going to talk to somebody, you would look over your shoulder in a Soviet country. So you're at a restaurant. Before you're going to say something, you want to make sure that the KGB is not listening. That's exactly the country we're living in right now. Where if you go to get coffee and you're going to go tell your friend that you think men are men and women are women, and that men can't become women, and that they're delusional if they think that, you're going to probably turn around before you say that at a coffee shop.
That's actually it's considered discrimination at our school on the on our paperwork. You read it, yeah.
Yeah, that's sick stuff.
To say that.
I mean, you should sue. And this is a public university. Someone's got to sue over that because that's protected speech. That is really, really unbelievable.
Yes, it should be.
So I'm discriminating when I say that?
According to UCF.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
So what is the answer? What is the answer? Only you have the answer. What matters more, career or courage? Career or courage? I think being a courageous person at a young age is a much better decision than having an expedient or materially benefiting career, because you might get that career and then you'll be miserable because you can't speak your mind. God bless you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Good evening, Charlie. I want to say this is surreal to me because this is my first time. I'm a freshman. This is my first time ever coming to an event like this. My TV basically was watching you, Ben Shapiro, Michael Knowles, Jordan Peterson when he joined the Daily Wire. I grew up on you, basically.
That's so very sweet. Thank you.
This is – I'm a bit nervous. I'll just say it.
No, it's okay. Take your time.
I want to say that was a fantastic point to go back off of, because on the subject of courage, because when I was in high school, I openly fought this stuff, and there were some liberals in my school. Granted, it was a Christian school, and yet there were still some crazy ideas like that. And a lot of my peers often told me I was courageous. I was very loud, and people often thought I was rude because of that. And now coming here, first day, not even kidding, it wasn't even the first day orientation, I saw some greasy looking abortion activists and telling my the person who was leading us to F off. And I've noticed myself that I was slowly becoming not meek but weak and not as well spoken. And I remember you said earlier that it's better to live loud and to have courage.
Yes.
How do you do that effectively?
That's a beautiful question. Give it up, friend. That's not easy to come and ask a question. That's really good. So, you want to know the trick?
Yes, sir.
You have to decide to be courageous. That's it. It doesn't take a superpower. It doesn't take a special school you go to, a special class. You make a decision tonight that I will be courageous. What is courage? Doing the right thing when you don't know how it's going to work out. That's it. When there's risk and there's chance, that's courage. When there's certainty, it's not courage, right? It's not courageous to text your friend. You're like, okay, hey, there's nothing courageous there. It's courageous to stand up to a bully. It's courageous to stand up to a professor. One of the reasons why our country is collapsing is because good people are not courageous people. You can be a good person and believe the right thing, but also not be courageous. So just be 1% more courageous. And that doesn't mean you have to be reckless. That doesn't mean you have to make, you know, a big scene. But I don't know if you're a Christian or not. But
I am.
Then pray for God for wisdom, and he'll give it to you abundantly. James 1:5. And he'll reveal himself and his perfect will in that way. God bless you, man. Thanks so much for being here. Thank you.
I want to continue something.
I'm sorry.
I have one more thing.
I got to get to the next question, okay, but fine. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
All right. First of all, hi.
Hello.
I'm a little nervous, so if I stuttered, forgive me.
No worries. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem. So I grew up liberal, and it's now been a year and a half that I've now jumped on the conservative train.
God bless you.
And so with that, I'm really familiar about the liberal views, and I'm still like a little brand new to the conservative, and right now I'm still like a little mixed feelings about the guns and stuff, because like I've been told by people like, hey, you cannot be a Christian and support the guns because they're barbaric.
Guys, remember our rule: be respectful. Don't laugh at people.
They're barbaric. They're violent. Look how many people that were killed. And I was like, but look at the people like Hitler and the other tyrannical leaders that are like banning them and people can't defend themselves. So like
that's a good response.
Yeah. I didn't totally like that. I was pretty shy to speak up.
That's
but
okay.
Like, I want to hear from your point of view as sure. a man of God, why do Christians support the Second Amendment?
It's a great, that's a beautiful question. By the way, thank you. May your journey be purposeful and bright. Onward to the
God bless you.
Conservative side of things. And happy, because we are much happier than the other side. So first of all, a gun is a piece of technology. It's what you do with it. So a gun in and of itself is not a morally good or a morally bad thing. A gun can be something that can save somebody's life. In fact, you know, praise God that good guys can have guns and interrupt mass shootings, or that a pregnant mom at home has a gun to protect herself if somebody comes in to go in and try and harm them. So this idea of Christian passivity is not actually found in the Bible. Christ himself said to go buy a sword.
That's pretty much why, yeah.
Yeah, and so,
but
go
I
ahead.
I was also told that he's peaceful, he is loving, but then...
Yeah, so they're not reading the whole Bible. So Jesus is peace, but peace is not the absence of conflict. Peace is having Christ in the conflict. It's completely different. And so we should not seek strife. We should be blessed are the peacemakers. We should try to make peace. But if an innocent or a child, for example, you know, let's use an example where Jesus singled it out, is to be harmed, you have a moral right in biblical Christianity to defend the child and use any force necessary so that child will not be harmed. Yeah. Including your family and including those that you steward. And so the Second Amendment also, though, protects one of God's priorities in the Bible, which is God's heart for his people is that people do not live in tyranny. That whether it be God delivering his chosen people from Egypt in the Exodus, whether it be John 10:10, the enemy comes to lie, steal, cheat, and destroy, I've come to give life and life more abundantly. One of the messages of Christ's teachings is liberation, is not to live under some form of tyranny. You cannot have a free society unless the people are able to check and balance government if it becomes tyrannical. And this is the unpopular argument that needs to be said, though, that God forbid our government ever becomes so tyrannical that we'll have to defend ourselves. But if the Americans owned no weapons, period, the government would have all the control to do whatever they want all the time. That's a hostage situation. If the people own weapons, it's a negotiation. And people might say, well, Charlie, that's pretty extreme. Well, in Mao, they took away the weapons. Mao's China. Hitler took away the weapons. Mussolini took away the weapons. And so as a Christian, we must fight for a free society. Jeremiah 29:7, demand the welfare of the nation that you are in because your welfare is tied to your nation's welfare. And if I care about my nation's welfare, I want free people to be able to own weapons and defend themselves against a usurpatious, tyrannical government, against criminal thugs that might come to their home. But understand that the gun itself is not inherently good or bad. It is what is done with that piece of technology. Anybody who's afraid of guns is just that. They're afraid of a piece of technology that could be used in a certain way. You lock a gun in a gun closet, it's not going to do anything. It's the person that does that. So what they're talking about is really a heart problem and a soul problem. But I could tell you this, it would be a disaster and it would be a catastrophe if we disarmed the American population. It would be bad for Christianity. It would be bad for the country and it'd be bad for children. So that's my answer. Thank you so much. I got to get to the next one. Sorry. Thank you. All right. We'll take a couple more. We're already over time, but I was late. So yes.
Hey, Charlie. My name's Sebastian. You did really good with like clarifying everything politically with Israel. But as a conservative Christian, I can't ignore everyone saying, you know, that the prophecies found in Isaiah, Ezekiel, yeah. about the end of times.
Isaiah 17:1.
Correct. Yeah. And all the prophecies, I would say, you know, is, I don't want to be hysterical, but, you know, is it the end of the world or
yeah,
is
no,
it not?
This is a real thing. First of all, I have no idea. I'm not a theologian. But I will add some context because my phone has been lighting up like a Christmas tree. With pastors that are saying, this is it. This is the end times. For those of you that don't know, if you're not a Christian, in normative Christian theology, without getting too big into pre-trib, post-trib, you know, eschatology, that there is an end of the world as we know it. Get it? Like the song. And depending on how you read the scriptures, the more normative Christian theology is that there's a tribulation period. Christ calls that as birth pains, right? That you'll see rumors of war and war itself and earthquakes and famine. And then at a specific point, Christ will return to earth and then engage in a thousand-year reign. That's normative Christian theology. I missed some parts of it, but that's mixing parts of Ezekiel and Isaiah and Revelation and Matthew. That's basic. There's a lot more to that. Here's where I fall, which is, it's fine to look at the signs of the time. Jesus said that the day and the hour will be unknown. In year 1000, they thought Jesus was going to return. In year 1300, they thought Jesus was going to turn. In year 1550, they thought Jesus was going to turn. In 2011, many people thought Jesus was going to return. And maybe they're right. You know, they say, oh my goodness, Israel's going to bomb Damascus, fall of Damascus, Isaiah 17:1. The most important question instead is, what should I do? And instead of just looking at the signs of the time saying, Jesus is going to zap me up next Thursday, what's the point in fighting? We should say, we're going to occupy till he comes, to be salt and light and to be a force for goodness. And so I intentionally avoid the end times talk because I find it to be unhelpful. So I'm going to be on the welcoming committee, not the planning committee, when Christ returns. Okay?
Great answer, Charlie. Thank you.
And I'll just close with this, which is, anybody who tells you decisively they know it's the end times, we're explicitly commanded not to make those claims. Right. Instead, we should be focused on being as holy and good and faithful as we can. That is the operative answer to that.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you so much.
My name's Antonio, and to return a little more to the political side.
Sure.
I want to know, earlier you said that it was a better strategy to use Russia as a hedge against China.
Yeah.
When I want to understand your thinking on why that would be better than working against China's foreign investments to gain leverage.
So we definitely so foreign investments where? In Russia, you mean?
No, not in Russia. In like developing nations.
We definitely should. Yeah. So without getting too deep into the geopolitics, I think China is the great evil of our time. And almost everything stacks up to the CCP, right? I think Russia pales in comparison to the existential threat the Chinese Communist Party poses to our way of life and to our civilization, right? So everything must be viewed through the lens of, what decision are we making to restrain the rise of China and build coalitions to weaken China? Just understand my perspective, right? So that means we should go after Belt and Road, right? We should go after their infiltration of our universities, Confucius Institutes. But I think it's silly if we are inviting a new coalition that destabilizes the dollar, by the way, where the first time in your lifetime the dollar might be completely abolished and destroyed. They call it BRICS, right? The developing countries, which is just basically like a new international order that is created. India, the fact that India is part of it is unacceptable. Our politicians shouldn't put up with it. But it's Brazil because they have a new leader. They got rid of Bolsonaro and they put in Lula. Thank you. Yeah, we ran out of time. Sorry. Have a good night. BRICS. So BRICS continues. So everything comes to that lens. Here's what I'll say. I don't think Russia's a good country. I don't think it's a great country. I don't like Putin. I think he's a thug. I don't share a like passionate hatred of Russia that a lot of people in D.C. have. I just don't. I don't fear them. I don't think they're going to do a land invasion of the United States. I think that they are, you know, liars and cheaters in a lot of different things, but it's a fact that they conveniently avoid that we were able and willing to partner with Joseph Stalin to defeat Nazi Germany in World War II. And I'm afraid a lot of this posture out of Washington, D.C. Is kind of this mix of Cold War nostalgia, and they're basically obsessed with like the fact that Russia has not become completely European and embraced like all of these wacky ideas that have permeated Europe. And so it's a complex answer, but I for one am just shocked, but I'm disappointed that leaders in both parties, Republicans are just as guilty as Democrats, are not saying, can we just have some form of peace in the Russia-Ukraine conflict? Stop the killing, stop the slaughter. And I think the fact that we're subsidizing the flow of arms and weapons is a major mistake. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, so closing thoughts, everybody. If you want to come out to Phoenix, Arizona for America Fest, it's amazing. We have the biggest speakers in the entire movement. It's going to be incredible. Promo code LIVEFREE for an AmFest discount. I want to thank you guys for taking time tonight. For those of you that are fighting on campuses, make a decision to be courageous. It's the most important, most fruitful thing you can do. We live in a country that is in bad shape. So you have two ways you can think about it. You can give up, surrender, and despair. One of my favorite teachings in the book of Deuteronomy is that to despair is a sin. Every day, you must actively push back against despairing. Ask yourself, for those of you that are Christians, your prayer should be, God, not solve this. God, use me to solve this. Use me as a vessel to solve the problem. And we live in a great country. We did not build it. We inherited it. I've dedicated my life to try to get as many people to care, to be thankful, and to fight for this beautiful republic. It starts with you guys, and I'm very honored you took time tonight. And thank you for the questions, and God bless UCF. Thank you guys so much. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email us, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening, and God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.
The United States Constitution guarantees every American fundamental rights and protection of life, liberty, and property. Salem is celebrating our founding document with a special offer, a 1953 Oman U.S. Constitution lithograph. Understand the value of these lithographs is another story. A master lithographer, immigrant named Theodore Oman, came to this country to find the American dream. 70 years ago in 1953, Oman printed a limited number of these exceptional Constitution lithographs. Go to SalemEventStore.com to read Oman's entire story. America's most important document stands as a testament to all Americans to maintain their liberties, freedoms, and inalienable rights. Buy it and display it proudly. Buy a gift for your family and friends, for all the teachers in your communities. There's a limited number, so act today. Go to SalemEventStore.com to get your exclusive 1953 Oman U.S. Constitution lithograph. Buy it and display it proudly. While limited supplies last, there's a limited time, so act today. SalemEventStore.com, SalemEventStore.com.